Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everybody, this is Angela Orkin. I'm excited to introduce you to the podcast today. At True North Child Advocates, we believe strongly in the value of judicial leadership. And in today's podcast, Bill sits down with former Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, Justice Barbara Pariente. Justice Pariente was appointed in December of 1997 and retired in January of 2019. She sat on the court during the high-profile cases of Bush v. Gore and Bush v. Schiavo. But today's interview focuses on her advocacy for children in the court system. We're truly grateful that Justice Pariente took the time to talk with us, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Through your tenure, and I assume it's through the entire tenure, you've had a very, or you've placed a lot of emphasis on families and children in the court. And that's what I really, where I really want to go today with you. And so, I guess while you were, you obviously, cases regarding dependency or neglect and delinquency came across your desk, and I know that you did author some majority opinions in some of those cases. You also were the chair of the Supreme Court Steering Committee on Families and Children in the Courts. So you've had this interest in families and children in the court. What happened?
This is the interesting story, and I don't know, Bill, because we've known each other for a long time, if you even know this. I did not do any work in dependency or delinquency, and I had two dissolution of marriage cases while I was in private practice that were one involved children, one did not. And I said after that, there's got to be a better way to do dissolution of marriage cases. They don't belong in the courts. You've got people that have high emotions and sometimes too much money. So there has to be a way to have alternative dispute resolutions and take these matters outside the court, especially, you know, if it's money that's an issue, accountants can do it. If they're suffering from mental illness or alcohol or drug dependence, again, somebody else can deal with that. But the courts really are not, in my view, equipped to handle those cases. So I came to the Supreme Court with this idea that I was going to come up with a system to get all the dissolution of marriage cases, all the divorce cases, out of the court system. In the course of that, and I say this looking back 21 years, I discovered the whole area of domestic violence, of dependency, of delinquency, that really weren't areas that could be taken out of the court system. They were absolutely needed the court's attention. But then the challenge was that the legal problems, the legal issues, were rarely complex, but it was the underlying drug issues, alcohol issues, domestic violence, mental illness, that was oftentimes driving what was happening. And certainly, as you know, in dependency, over 90% of the parents, they're not bad parents, but they are parents that have really bad problems and they're not able to cope. And so I came to this area through beginning to understand that there was a whole area of social science, of brain science, of mental health, drug addiction, that was not being really looked at by the courts.
You know, it's when you say that, I realized when I got into juvenile law, what I call the juvenile law, dependency, neglect, delinquency, I soon realized I can't just be a lawyer. I have to be like almost a doctor. I've got to be a therapist, or at least have an understanding of all of these professions and how they impact on the families. Because it's so much more than just, okay, what's a law say? And what are the facts here that tie into the elements? It's beyond that. What do you think of that?
Well, I totally agree. And it makes the area of children, representation of children, even representation of families, of parents, much more complicated. So I don't want to discourage anyone from from saying, oh, what, this isn't an area I want to get involved in. What it means is that both for the lawyers and the judges and those within the system, that the education has to be ongoing and educate not only on here's the law, but here is the latest and most important aspects of the underlying science, underlying mental health issues, that you can't just address this as a legal problem.
I think that's why I love this area of law. I'm someone who reads incessantly anyway about almost anything. And I literally fell into this. And loving it so much because I did have to learn about so many areas of life, really. And
you know what? Maybe that's also what interested me, because it was so much more nuanced, but the ability to recognize those mm-hmm. issues, to be able to advocate as either a lawyer or understand it as a judge, could make all the difference in the world, which is why I started to really emphasize, as I both chaired the Committee on Children and Families in the Court, but also as Chief Justice, to at every opportunity speak to judges that these divisions, the family divisions, and in Florida we have general jurisdiction courts, we don't have separate family courts, but that these divisions, cases involving children and families from dissolution of marriage to dependency, delinquency, termination, parental rights, domestic violence, were the most important divisions, because what I would say, and I say today, is that what we do or fail to do could change the trajectory of that child and family's life forever.
Right.
So imagine an opportunity just after a child is born, and we're now looking at 0 to 3, and what we have in Florida, the early childhood courts, mm-hmm. and being able to recognize what the trauma has already been, but what can be prevented by intervention. Now, again, the judge and the lawyer can't do it all.
Right.
It does take, you know, they say that it takes more. It takes a team. And certainly in drug courts, Florida was a pioneer in drug courts, mental health courts, but all of that information, it came in a way to, it's come later into the family courts, yet they're dealing with all those issues. But you were saying that you have to know much more. But the important thing is that there are, you know, we know of expert witnesses that are needed and often used in dissolution of marriage cases, family therapists. It isn't on the judge, or shouldn't be on the judge alone, to try to figure that out. You
right.
know, sometimes judges say, well, oh, I understand this because of something in their background. No, we don't want our judges making their decisions based on something in their own background.
Right.
For the same token, a lawyer, why lawyers representing children are so important is because they can bring to the table the importance of the child, what is going on in the child's life, depending on when he or she comes into the system. The importance of stability. So this idea that there might be a child that has, heavens forbid, 10 foster placements in a year, or how that the child is even removed from the home. I mean, I have one of my staff attorneys was a foster parent, and I have another person I know who's a foster parent, and others, you know, they're removed in the middle of the night, and they're with a new family.
Right.
That, you don't think that is, well, you know that's traumatic. We oftentimes don't think about it. Or school stability. Why do foster children do more poorly in school? Well, it's the whole history of trauma, but it's also that with each placement, they have to move where they, what school they're in, it's traumatic. But we don't see that with those children that should be treated as good, if not better, than our own, because they've been placed in the state's the responsibility of the state, and in the awesome responsibility of the court system.
Right. And for us, John, Jim, myself, and Angela, we are really advocating a permanency-focused litigation style. You know, not only, and we'll talk more a lot about trauma today, but not only are they traumatized, but the longer they remain in care, it's a further trauma. It leads me to a question. There's a responsibility on us in the sense that we, while we're litigating or representing the child, or while the judge is making a decision, what is that impact? And to me, that's where we really need to focus. But it's almost hard to do that because how can you do that, right? Does that make sense?
It depends on how many cases you have. You know, we have all of that. That's why I know at Legal Aid, the Foster Children's Project, that this is in Palm Beach County, and it's what I'm familiar with and has further reinforced the need for quality professional representation, that you have social workers, masters of social workers that help advise you. You have the advantage of the home study. So you have resources, and fortunately, your caseloads are at a manageable level. We have the responsibility to try to, and I agree with you, get the child to permanency as expeditiously as possible. And if lawyers, trained professional lawyers, can help the judge recognize that need, and we place those child into permanent situations earlier, the outcome is undeniably going to be better. It's almost as if you look at a case and say, I know that in the first 3 months of this case, or the first 60 days of this case, I am going to be doing the majority of the work to understand what's going on. That's a major responsibility. But if that information is quality at the beginning, it seems to me that it will allow for a better outcome and a more an expeditious one. It's why the federal guidelines say 1 year. Mm-hmm. It's 1 year is a long time,
even. It is a long period.
But if judges are only required to have case management conferences every 60 days or 90 days, mm-hmm. That's why, again, in Florida, in our early childhood courts, there's much more frequent case management. My view is there needs to be frequent case management in every case of a dependent child.
So when we get to your level, these are appellate attorneys usually that are coming before you presenting a case. And what would you tell an appellate attorney?
First of all, understand, and I know your listening audience understands, that most of the work occurs at the trial courts. And in Florida, we do a great deal with judicial education, training, both when the judges are entering these divisions and ongoing, to teach about the process and also about much more of the science, trauma-informed education. As far as then the appellate court, which would be the next level, most of the cases they will get are cases where the parental rights have already been terminated. There, the most important thing that I've always emphasized, and I did this when I was on the appellate court, as well as one of the things I did was when I was on the Florida Supreme Court as a result of some nationwide impetus, was to make sure that that appeal was expedited. Mm-hmm. Again, under the understanding that every day that decision was delayed meant that child was in limbo, that child would not be eligible for adoption. So if the rights had been terminated and then the child was with the potential, whether it's foster care or adoptive parents' home, and there was uncertainty, that was traumatic both for the parent, the adoptive parent, as well as for the child. Okay. The second part is that the answer is there is not as much education at the appellate level on the nature of the dependency system, and certainly not at the Supreme Court level. So my view is that the appellate attorney should paint a picture of who that child is, if it's an advocacy for upholding the trial court's decision. Certainly, if it's a termination of parental rights, most likely the child's attorney or guardian ad litem have agreed with that. So then the challenge is what, you know, it's drastic. Even though for us as children's child-centered, we know it's best, it's still, it's a parent, quote, losing their child, maybe forever. And so therefore, the question is, why did it happen? And there is where if the trial record has not been adequate, it can be a problem. So that, again, is what do? You make sure that your record is complete as possible at the trial court level. You make sure your judge there is educated. You make sure that the orders that are entered are thorough and explain the basis. If there's an unusual appellate issue, then I strongly urge, and I've seen it done many times, that even Legal Aid Foster Children's Project or the University of Miami Children's Project will ask to file what's called an amicus brief, a friend of the court. That will help inform what the legal issue is and maybe what even, and hopefully, what the other ramifications are. So that's where you get your education. It's probably, as far as understanding the system, we know that there's a great deal of dysfunction in the foster care system, not necessarily from the point of view of the attorneys or the judges, but all of the players. There are a lot of players that are involved in the decision-making process. And so sometimes understanding who all those people are may be helpful. But it's to give a picture of, here's the issue. You have the advantage if you're advocating for upholding the judge's decision, that the judge's, you know, the findings of fact are presumed correct, and you don't want to re-argue the facts. So if you're dealing with a discrete issue of law, it helps to have the context. But if it's, you know, oftentimes it might be a question of statutory interpretation, and there the judges are well qualified to use the traditional methods of statutory construction.
So having, knowing all of that, it would seem to me that representation for children is important. What do you think of that? In these dependency type cases.
First of all, in the first 3 years, there's no difference between best interests and express wishes, but expediting the placement and recognizing and advocating to the court as part of that case type is critical. Now, I mentioned early childhood courts. They have other ways of dealing with it, but to me, an attorney has an essential role there. As that child gets older, that child needs to feel they're being listened to. So they have a voice, they have their attorney to be able to, for them to talk to their attorney, to express what's going on, and to inform the decision-making process. Does that mean that whatever that child wants to go back to an abusive home, that's dangerous? That's not going to happen. And the attorney is not going to advocate for that dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. But before the decision is made, the attorney has the opportunity to really spend some time and have a trust relationship with the client to be able to explain why it's not healthy for them to do what they think they want to do. And so there are, I am sure there must be 100 different benefits to this representation. And in the end, it benefits the child, it benefits the system, it benefits the judge in decision making, and hopefully it benefits the whole family in ensuring an outcome that will lead to a healthy future for that child, most importantly.
So we hope you've enjoyed the interview so far. Please stay tuned for part 2. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.